ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 17th of April. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Political and faith leaders are pleading for calm following Monday's terror attack at a Sydney church service as police work to prevent any possible reprisal attacks. During the incident, a teenager allegedly stabbed the bishop of an Assyrian Orthodox church during a live-streamed mass. It led to a violent crowd surge outside. Experts say careful messaging is needed to prevent vulnerable people adopting extremist beliefs. Gavin Coote reports.
The tight-knit Assyrian community in Sydney's southwest is in shock, and the members of a church in which the stabbing happened say they feel a sense of violation.
Never expected something like this.
Jacqueline Georges, a member of the Assyrian Orthodox Christian Church, is devastated her place of worship became the target of what's been deemed a terror attack.
We felt we were safe. We left our countries because of these things, and today we're facing this here.
There were violent scenes outside the church on Monday night after a 16-year-old allegedly stabbed Bishop Mar Mari Emanuel in the face during a live-streamed mass. The bishop has attracted hundreds of thousands of people to his preachings and has been outspoken in his views regarding the LGBTQI community and a critic of the COVID lockdowns and vaccines. Angry crowds swirled in response to the stabbing attack, resulting in injured police and damaged police vehicles. It's been condemned by police and political leaders, including Albanese Government Minister Chris Bowen, whose Western Sydney electorate takes in surrounding suburbs.
Bear in mind that the police now need to be allowed to do their job, that religions have lived alongside, side by side here in our community for many generations, and that will continue. And that there is no place at all for vigilante action or some sort of response.
Religious leaders have held two meetings since Monday and are urging for calm amid fears of possible reprisal attacks. Bilal Raouf from the Australian National Imams Council stresses the need for people of all faiths to stand together.
It's absolutely critical that we are not so easily divided. Unfortunately, among us there are those who will play to prejudices and biases and various negative elements, but we need to resist that.
Sydney is also still reeling from the Bondi Junction mass murder, and now the church stabbing has put the city even more on edge. The stabbing of the bishop has been declared an act of terror, with police saying the 16-year-old suspect was motivated by religious extremism. Dr. Imogen Richards, a criminologist at Deakin University who researches extremism, cautions leaders on how they call for unity.
I think openly acknowledging what the potential grievances that different communities might have, providing access to resources and communication and through sort of really community-based grassroots engagement with different communities, I think is really vital right now.
Westfield Bondi Junction Shopping Centre remains closed as investigations continue into the death of six people killed by Joel Couchy on Saturday. Police say they may never get a clear answer on why the 40-year-old committed such horrific violence.
That report by Gavin Coote and Tony Ibrahim. Julian Assange's bid to avoid extradition in the United States has been dealt a blow after lawyers for the US government gave assurances to the British High Court about his treatment. The court had sought guarantees about how the WikiLeaks founder would be dealt with before the US courts should the Australian be extradited. Mr. Assange is fighting attempts to send him there to face charges over the publishing of confidential US military records and diplomatic cables. Here's Cayman Gok from London.
Today was the deadline and lawyers for the White House responded. The United States has provided assurances requested by the High Court in London regarding Julian Assange's treatment if he is extradited. Last month, the court asked the US to guarantee the 52-year-old Australian could rely on America's First Amendment, which protects free speech, that he's not prejudiced because of his nationality and that he will not face the death penalty. Rebecca Vincent from Reporters Without Borders says the response from the US was expected.
Our position remains, though, that regardless of any assurances provided, these grounds can deserve proper consideration by the court. It shouldn't be done away with just on the basis of essentially political promises.
The WikiLeaks founder has been fighting extradition to America since 2019 and faces 18 charges for publishing classified documents. His wife, Stella Assange, in a statement said the US has used blatant weasel words in its assurances and that today's development does nothing to relieve our family's extreme distress about his future. And that's because there is a catch. The US says he will have the ability to raise and rely on the First Amendment, but a decision of whether or not it can be applied is exclusively the purview of the US court system. Here's Julian Assange's former lawyer, Jeffrey Robertson.
The crucial thing is that these assurances cannot cover what the courts will do. If a Trump judge decides that Julian Assange cannot gain the protection of the First Amendment because he's an Australian, that's something that prosecution cannot guarantee will not happen.
Assange remains in custody in London's Belmarsh prison. Last week, President Biden said he was considering Australia's request to drop the prosecution. Here's Rebecca Vinson again.
We've called for a long time for the Biden administration to find a solution to this case and have been encouraged by efforts of the Australian government to raise this case in their own negotiations with the US. We still hope that that could create as well a path out of this, but it's still possible for the courts to deliver that as well.
Lawyers for the US and Assange will return to court on May 20. The justices will then make a call on whether Assange can be extradited or he's given another chance to appeal. This is Cayman Gock in London reporting for AM.
This morning, Australia's High Court will start hearing a case which could have significant consequences for the nation's immigration detention system. Lawyers for an Iranian man who's refusing to cooperate with efforts to deport him argue he must be released from detention. They're hoping to piggyback off another High Court ruling from last year, which upended more than 20 years of immigration detention policy and led to 150 people being released into the community. Here's political reporter Matthew Doran.
As the chill of a Canberra autumn descends over the nation's capital, another immigration detention battle is about to heat up in the High Court. A case brought by a 37-year-old bisexual man from Iran, known by the pseudonym ASF17, who arrived in Australia by boat over a decade ago. Anne Toomey is Professor Emerita at the University of Sydney Law School.
The question in this particular case is, well, what if the person themselves is preventing their own removal during that foreseeable future? So they hold the key to their own prison.
Since 2018, officials have been trying to deport ASF17 back to Iran, but he's refusing to cooperate, insisting he'll be persecuted there on the basis of his sexuality. His lawyers insist Iran wouldn't accept him anyway, given the country's practice of refusing to accept involuntary returnees, and that the Commonwealth can't keep him in detention on the unlikely prospect he'll change his mind and work with authorities in future. Professor Toomey says ASF17 is hoping to build on the High Court's landmark ruling last year, which found indefinite detention was unlawful if there was no reasonable prospect of deportation.
Can you effectively force your release and your movement back into the Australian community by simply refusing to cooperate, thereby stymieing the ability of the government to deport you and then still satisfying that test?
Any ruling by the High Court will have significant implications. On Monday, the Home Affairs Department was being grilled by the Senate on proposed legislation from the government to make it easier to deport people, laws fuelled by the concerns over the ASF17 case. Officials revealed there were between 150 and 200 people currently in immigration detention refusing to cooperate with efforts to deport them. More than 4,400 others are on bridging visas awaiting deportation efforts, and the Home Affairs Department's Michael Thomas said part of that cohort could prove problematic.
It's approximately 1,200 where the department believes that there may be an issue with their departure if they do not voluntarily engage.
Last year, when the High Court made its ruling in the case of a Rohingya man known as NZYQ, it took many by surprise, not just because it overturned two decades of legal precedent, but the fact the court heard arguments from counsel and then issued its decision on the same day, delivering its reasons for the judgment a couple of weeks later. Professor Anne Toomey isn't sure the justices would be keen for a repeat of the political chaos with another quick ruling.
My suspicion is that the High Court will probably be a bit more reticent about taking that approach to again, but I could be wrong.
In a statement, a spokesperson for the Immigration Minister, Andrew Giles, said the government's position is that individuals who have no right to remain in Australia should be removed from Australia.
Political reporter Matthew Doran. The return of international tourists to Australia appears to be stalling, with numbers down almost 30% on 2019. Last year, more than 6 million people visited, down around 2 million visitors of pre-pandemic times. Experts say the international recovery is being held back by a lack of capacity on key overseas routes, expensive airfares, and the rising cost of hotels and restaurants. Here's tourism reporter Christy Sexton-McGrath.
For 2 years, Marcela Ribeiro worked three jobs to save for her dream holiday to Australia. Like millions of people from across the globe, the 35-year-old from Brazil had long wanted to explore the country's world-famous destinations, specifically the Great Barrier Reef and World Heritage-listed rainforest in far north Queensland. She landed in Cairns a few days ago, and the costs of travelling in Australia are beginning to pinch.
My air flight, it was expensive because Brazil is so far from Australia. Dining out, I thought it was a bit expensive.
It's a similar scenario for Dutch couple Tim Aronson and Leila Malecki, who are also holidaying in the tropical north.
The flight tickets are expensive, especially after COVID. I think they went up a lot. The rest of the trip, yeah, it's the expenses mostly because we stay quite a long time. We estimated around 10,000 euro, so that's $15,000, $16,000.
You have come all the way here and you don't do it every year probably, so we try to, you know, just enjoy.
COVID-19 wreaked havoc across the country's economy, but nowhere was the pain as instant or more devastating as in the tourism industry. In 2019, 8.7 million tourists visited Australia from overseas in an industry that was worth $166 billion to the economy. Figures from Tourism Research Australia show there were only 6.6 million international visitors last year, a deficit of more than 2 million overseas tourists compared to 2019. Chinese visitor numbers, who made up the bulk of visitors to Australia pre-pandemic, slumped to 507,000 last year, less than half of what they were before the international border closed. Professor Gui Lohmann from Griffith University's Institute for Tourism says there's many reasons for the slow return of international visitors, cost being just one of them.
We know that the airfares are significantly high in terms of labour costs and food costs are expensive as well. It could be challenging for Australia to really reach above 8 million international visitors if we are in that particular scenario.
He says there's been a reset in the way Europeans holiday since the pandemic.
The mindset that a long-haul trip is quite damaging to the environment and climate change and so forth. Europeans are getting less and less used to fly internally. A lot of routes simply, they do not exist and they are replaced by train trips.
Tourism Australia, a government agency that promotes holidays, launched a global ad campaign to entice them to return.
G'day.
Where am I?
Australia.
A spokeswoman said travel from China only resumed a year ago and numbers were increasing month by month.
Christy Sexton-McGrath reporting there. Every year, thousands of children seek help from homelessness services, but around half are turned away because there's not enough crisis accommodation. Children as young as 12 are resorting to couch surfing and returning to violent homes or sleeping in unsafe and insecure conditions. Polling by Essential Media shows about 80% of Liberal, Labor and Greens voters all want governments to do more. So advocates are renewing their calls for a youth homelessness strategy, as Annie Guest reports.
With the family home deeply dysfunctional, this young Tamworth resident faced a tough choice.
I was roughly 14 when I left home for the first time due to family ongoing issues. There was a lot of alcohol and drug use at the house. My dad was letting one of my abusers continuously live with me and us at that house. So it wasn't a safe space for me to be at.
2 years later, she was pregnant and facing a new danger.
So I was rough sleeping. I met a boy through a friend. And within 3 months of that relationship, it had turned both emotionally and physically abusive, mentally abusive, sexually abusive and financially abusive.
She finally received support from a homelessness service. And the now 20-year-old has a TAFE qualification, a job and a healthy child, but wishes she'd had help earlier.
It could have prevented some very, very nasty things happening in my life.
But with 40,000 Australians under 24 turning up at homeless services each year and about half of them needing immediate accommodation, services are stretched, including at Project Youth in southern Sydney, where Jodie Darge is the CEO.
We housed on average about 150 young people per year in the accommodation that we have available to us, but we turn away just under 1,000. Honestly, it's absolutely heartbreaking.
In a statement to AM, the Minister for Housing and Homelessness, Julie Collins, says the government is working collaboratively to develop the National Housing and Homelessness Plan, backed by more than $25 billion in planned housing investments to deliver more homes for Australians who need them. But Trish Connolly from the Peak Group Y Foundations argues these policies are not fit for purpose.
What we really need is a standalone National Child and Youth Homelessness Plan that addresses all the needs of children and young people, not a plan designed for adults.
The minister didn't directly respond to the call for a standalone youth homelessness plan, saying the government is working with states, territories and community groups to help more young Australians experiencing homelessness.
Any guest. After a marathon campaign, voters in Solomon Islands will go to the polls today in an election that will be closely watched around the region. Manasa Sogavare is aiming to be the first incumbent Prime Minister to win re-election after serving a full term in office and has been promoting his decision to embrace closer ties with China. It's a milestone which Australian officials are quietly hoping he won't reach. Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts filed this report from Honiara.
The streets of Honiara are slowly going quiet after weeks of electioneering. Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare has run hard on his decision to switch diplomatic recognition to China and sign a contentious security pact with Beijing. In return, China's poured money into flagship projects like the National Stadium in Honiara. And Mr. Sogavare says it's also won his country something more, international attention and respect.
And now we are known everywhere you go to America, people by talking about Solomon Islands. Because we register this country now on map because of powerful decisions, important decisions that you're making, we become relevant.
Mr. Sogavare has also praised China's political system, stirring unease in Canberra. He's likely the favourite to cobble together a winning coalition after the election and take power once again. But loyalties shift quickly in Solomon Islands and predictions are difficult. And some voters are frustrated by hopelessly inadequate services. In Honiara's dilapidated main hospital, Maria tells the ABC's The Pacific she's been waiting for hours to get her son medicine.
In terms of health, this is what we get, and it's really sad because maybe for those with money, they could afford to go to hospitals overseas. Meanwhile, for majority of us, we're stuck here.
Prominent opposition politician Peter Kenilorio Jr. says Mr. Sogavare has built an unhealthily close relationship with China.
The fact that the security deal was also signed. So it meant that we were also now becoming dependent, not just economically, but security-wise. For us, I don't see that balance anymore. When you become dependent, then you become vulnerable.
The political stakes are high, and this election will be very closely watched by observers from several different countries and multilateral organisations. James Batley from the Australian National University is helping to lead one of the teams to ensure the poll runs fairly and smoothly.
90% of our observers, of course, are Solomon Islanders themselves, and they'll be in the field for almost 3 weeks. During the campaigning period on election day itself, and we'll do some survey work after the elections as well.
And while voting will only take a day, don't expect a result anytime soon. The vote count could take up to 2 weeks. After that, negotiations to form a government will likely stretch even longer. A long wait for those watching both inside Solomon Islands and outside it as well.
Stephen Jedgetts there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It was a judgment watched closely across the country, as Justice Michael Lee meticulously outlined his ruling in the defamation case brought by Bruce Lehrman, leading to a dramatic finding against the former Liberal staffer that on the balance of probabilities, he raped Brittany Higgins. Today, we step through the civil judgment with court reporter Patrick Bell. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.